We've told stories of crime and punishment on this podcast, most of those stories happening to regular folks. But today we tell about such a story that happened to the heir of one of the wealthiest families / companies in the South. Hello, folks. I'm Steve Gilley, along with Rod Mullins, and this is Stories, a History of Appalachia.
You know, Steve, you mentioned the regular folks, these stories that happened and so forth. You know, we're kind of used to those things happening, I guess, in some portions of Appalachia. But, you know, this is one of those stories that kind of reminds me of, how can I say it, the Old South to a certain degree. It was one of those things that was, oh, you hush it up. But, you know, there's other things going on behind the scenes that you're not aware of. But this is one of those stories that was just like, man, it was like something you'd see in a soap opera in this day and age.
Well, as we record this podcast, you got Amber Heard and Johnny Depp.
Yes.
And that's all you're hearing about is Amber did this and Johnny did that. And she said he didn't. He said she did. That's this kind of story right here, but only it's way back in the 1920s, 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Zachary Smith Reynolds, youngest son of R.J. Reynolds. You've heard of him, haven't you, Rod?
Yes, I have.
And referred to as Smith, married Ann Cannon in York, South Carolina on November 16th, 1929. Now, he was very young at that point, just a teenager. But even so, Rod, he had an airplane that he could fly.
Wow.
After a week, Smith and his wife got in his airplane and left Winston-Salem to go to Richmond, Virginia, for something called the Virginia All-State Reliability Tour. I think that had something to do with the airplanes. Anyway, after leaving home, they first landed at Asheville and stayed the night in the George Vanderbilt Hotel.
Hmm.
They were referred to in newspapers as the Flying Honeymooners, and they were both teenagers. Now,
wow.
Ann was the daughter of J.F. Cannon, textile manufacturer, you know, Cannon Towels and all that. He was from Concord. This was a union of the two wealthiest families in North Carolina, but it was not destined to last because the couple soon separated and started negotiating a divorce settlement. But before that divorce, Ann and Smith had a child, Ann Cannon Reynolds II, born on August 23, 1930.
A consent judgment was signed on August 4, 1931. Now, it provided for trust funds for Ann and the child in the amount of $500,000, worth a total of $19 million today. In the agreement, Mrs. Reynolds would get a $500 a month, payment until she turned 25 years old, and then would get all the income from the $500,000 trust fund thereafter. By November, Ann was living in Reno, Nevada to establish residency to get a quickie divorce, and she filed for divorce in Reno on November 19th, 1931.
Well, the divorce was granted on November 23rd, 1931. Her testimony was given from her hotel room by deposition because she was suffering from rheumatism. She was accompanied by her father, who planned to have her carried to the train for the trip out of Nevada by stretcher. She testified that Smith Reynolds nagged her and swore at her and assumed such a domineering attitude that she was terribly nervous and upset all the time. And now, having gotten that out of the way, we get into the meat of this podcast. For Mr. Reynolds, who apparently was, heartbroken, 6 days later, he married on the rebound to a woman he'd become intensely infatuated with, a New York blues singer and actress from Cincinnati named Libby Holman. He'd been following Ms. Holman around the country in his airplane after meeting her in Baltimore when she performed in a play there. Now, Libby Holman was born on May 23, 1904 in Cincinnati and was 6 years older than the tobacco heir. She'd gone to New York City in the summer of 1924 to sing and perform on Broadway. The couple announced their marriage in May of 1932, saying only that it occurred a few months earlier in Hawaii. The two traveled and lived the life of the rich and famous at the family home Rinalda, a 600-acre estate in the Winston-Salem area, with a 2-acre lake and a private golf course. All appeared to be well, Rod, at least until that summer.
That's right. You know, I mean, hey, when you move up from chop steak to filet mignon, you know something's going to happen sooner or later. On July 7th, 1932, police were called to Rinalda because of a shooting. When they arrived, they found young Smith Reynolds dead from a gunshot wound to the head on the sleeping porch adjacent to his bedroom. Police and private guards barred the press and anyone else from nosing around about the death. A coroner's jury was convened, and it was ordered to the widow that she be taken into custody as a material witness. She was allowed to remain at the estate under guard of the officers in the care of the physician. Now, the physician was needed because Mrs. Reynolds was supposedly traumatized by the incident and had taken to bed. Kind of reminds me of the other incident that kind of happened, you know, in a case of where she had to be taken off by stretcher. But this time around, her mind was blank for the 2 days prior to her husband's death. At the coroner's inquest, she testified that she saw her husband put a pistol to his head and pull the trigger, and in a literal flash, watched him kill himself.
Before he pulled that trigger, she said, he called out her name. That evening, there had been a 21st birthday party for Charles Gideon Hill, a close friend of Reynolds and first cousin of his first wife, Anne. Also present was Smith's friend, 19-year-old Albert Walker, who himself was held as a material witness at the county jail. Her father, Albert Holtzman, served as Libby's counsel, for he was an attorney. Now, discrepancies soon arose over Libby Reynolds' testimony. At first, Libby stuck to the story that she and Smith had married in Hawaii early in 1932, then under intense questioning said that, well, no, they married in Monroe, Michigan on November 29, 1931 by a justice of the peace. A marriage license was soon uncovered from Michigan verifying this story. She also told the coroner they married because, well, one didn't need a parent's consent to marry if they were a minor, which Smith was, not quite being 21 yet. She also testified that Smith threatened suicide, fearing she would leave him, and urged her to have an affair with another man.
Well, Libby also said that Smith held a pistol to her head once, and she told him if he was going to kill himself, to kill her too, because she didn't want to live without him. According to her, wild looks would come to Reynolds' eyes every so often. Wonder what kind of wild looks those would have been, Steve. I don't know. Well, she also introduced two suicide notes from previous threats. Albert Walker testified that Reynolds tossed him, his pocketbook, and told him that he didn't need it because he had decided to end it all. A few minutes later, he told the jury he heard the shot that ended Reynolds' life. A nurse testified that she found Walker and Holman Reynolds in another room in the hospital, struggling to get up off the floor. She had said that Holman had told her that she was expecting a baby. Under questioning about this claim, Libby said she wasn't sure if she was pregnant or not.
This is getting interesting.
Yes, it is.
It was found that there had been drinking, moonshine, and near beer at this party, and Mrs. Reynolds partook of it quite liberally. Investigators found a blood-stained towel in Mrs. Reynolds' bathroom and reddish stains on that bathroom door identified as fingerprints. They had been found more than 72 hours after Reynolds died. The fingerprints were taken of all the people present that night. But in the end, the coroner's jury decided that Reynolds was murdered by an unknown assailant. Libby Reynolds then left Winston-Salem to return to Cincinnati with her parents. On July 22, 1932, Holman asked Smith's uncle, W.N. Reynolds, to be the executor of her husband's estate. It was thought she was getting ready to contest R.J. Reynolds' will, which would exclude her from any money since Smith was not yet 28 at the time of his death, and that the issue with that was that any money that was left to him would be in trust until he was 28, and if he didn't take it by 28, he wouldn't get it.
Right. Well, then, on July 24th, came reports that Libby Holman Reynolds was missing from her sister's home in Cincinnati and had not been seen in 6 days. Alfred Holman then went on the attack as a father and as a zealous attorney. He sent a telegram to the authorities in Forsyth County in which he said that zealous functionaries actuated by self-seeking motives, ignoring every canon of decency, were attempting to overcome the established self-destruction of young Reynolds. He promised that any time the cause of justice demands and her shattered mind and nerves permit, Mrs. Reynolds would be available for further inquiry. He also denied that Libby was missing. No comment was issued by Forsyth County officials on the telegram. Well, after a search for her by authorities, a warrant was issued for her arrest on a charge of murder, and Libby surrendered to North Carolina authorities on August 8th with a $25,000 bond issued, which was paid for by an heiress to, get this, the DuPont fortune, and then she was released. She appeared in court in black mourning clothes and a black veil.
Albert Walker was also arrested on a murder charge and was given a $25,000 bond. Unfortunately, he didn't have an heiress or an heir to post his bond, so he had to stay in jail for a little while. Mrs. Reynolds ended up going to Maryland to await trial, and Rod, she was indeed pregnant with a baby she intended to name after her late husband. In the same interview with the reporters, she denied shooting Smith Reynolds and said she loved him and he loved her. She also said that Walker worshipped his friend and wouldn't have shot him. She also demanded an acquittal and a complete apology from the Forsyth County officials. Well, by October, the state of North Carolina was starting to rethink its indictment of Holman and Walker, saying that there might not be enough evidence to convict and that the indictments might have to be dropped with a decision to be made in November. Holman herself, through her attorneys, demanded a trial to clear her good name and that she would reject any attempt for the state to nolly those indictments.
On November 15, 1932, murder charges were dropped against both Libby Holman and Albert Walker, and they were free. She announced that she would return to show business after the baby was born. On January 5, 1933, it was announced that Libby Holman Reynolds would be moving to Philadelphia from Delaware, where she had been staying since the murder case was dropped, to be close to the Pennsylvania Hospital, the oldest hospital in the United States, founded in 1751 by, among others, Benjamin Franklin. Then her son was born on January 10, 1933, prematurely at that hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was named Christopher Smith Reynolds, known as Topper, and he later died in a mountain climbing accident on August 7, 1950.
Now, Libby Holman went on to be involved in the civil rights movement, became a close friend with Martin Luther King Jr., and she had set up the Christopher Reynolds Foundation in honor of her son to support equality, international disarmament, and to help with environmental issues. And it was this foundation that provided funds for King to go to India to meet followers of Mahatma Gandhi, which influenced King to pursue a course of nonviolence. She married again, I think, twice, Rod. Divorced one more time and then married another fella. But she also had some relationships with women of note, including that DuPont heiress that posted her bond, which was probably her longest-lasting relationship, according to what I've read. She ended up dying on June 18, 1971, when she committed suicide in the front seat of her Rolls-Royce by carbon monoxide poisoning, apparently distraught over the way the country was headed in the late 60s and early 70s with the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the war in Vietnam.
Wow. This was an interesting story, and you know, you don't hear all this stuff, but you know, all the names, you were throwing all these names out, and here you were, R.J. Reynolds. That's what Winston-Salem is famous for, the Reynolds family. That's where the tobacco empire, if you really want to call it that, that's where it was established, and that was always reminded to me when I was driving, say, for example, down to the beach. I'd be going to the beach and going through Winston-Salem. There it is. This is the town that R.J. Reynolds and tobacco built. Then you start talking about the Cannon family. And, you know, for a time being, I lived in and around Martinsville, Virginia, and taught school there for a little while. And, you know, there's the remainder of all the mills and so forth of the old textile mills that they used to have. And then you get into the DuPont family. All of these were just, they were in like Flynn with one another in this, because I guess you could say the rich to a certain degree kind of looked after each other, maybe in that kind of connection. Would you say that's a fair kind of assessment?
They helped each other out in these
helped
cases,
each other.
Yes. Okay. I mean, could you imagine somebody being charged with murder and only getting a $25,000 bond?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For example, you know? This is one of those stories. It was just a very interesting little story that I thought I'd share with our listeners about, well, how things really don't change. As I said in the beginning, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp is just the 21st century version of Smith Reynolds and Libby Holman.
Well, I'm sure we won't be talking about dirty bed linens either, you know, from this story of, well, we won't go any further about the Johnny Depp Amber Heard story. We've heard enough of it already, so.
Yeah, more than enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the story of a North Carolina tobacco heir whose death set off a media frenzy in the 1920s and 1930s. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to the Stories Podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Good Pods, Odyssey, Audible, iHeartRadio, or on your favorite podcast app. Till next we meet, y'all take care. So long, everybody.